The House State Affairs Committee will please come to order at 5 minutes after 8. And I'd like to introduce on the committee Representative Peterson, Representative Seaton, on my far right, both politically and geographically, is Representative Johansson, and even further is Vice Chair Wes Keller. And so this morning we have on our agenda, as soon as I find it here, we have four pieces of legislation. We have HB 247, the Alaska National Guard Day. We have SCR 11, Walter Hickel Day of the Arctic. HB 77, nonpartisan blanket primary elections. And HB 287, absentee voting. And I'd like to point out that Representative Wilson is excused. She has a hearing on some other bill someplace. So with that, I'd like to start, please, with HB 247. That's National Guard Day. And let me get my folder here. Okay, HB 247 is a bill that's a prime co-sponsored by myself and Representative Dan Sadler. And it's a propitious number, and I'm going to steal a line from Representative Sadler. HB 247, I like to say that's actually, according to him, and I certainly agree, it's a bill about 24-7. The National Guard, Alaska National Guard, like all National Guards, are on duty, ready to work, ready to help Alaska on a 24-7 basis. And from the snowdrifts of Cordova to the battlefields of Iraq, the Alaska National Guard has been there to serve and to protect our citizens and interests, both here and abroad. The National Guard honors Alaska, and we should honor the National Guard with a special day of recognition, and that's really what this bill is all about, a one-paragraph bill. When Cordova was buried, not just a few days ago, under record snowfalls, the Guard answered the call, sending more than 50 members, supplies, and equipment to that stricken town. It was a typical National Guard response to a call for duty, a call for help. The 4,000 or so Guard members are guardians who respond quickly and efficiently to the state's called emergency and disaster relief mission, including, and here's some headlines about the Guard. Guard provides rescue support for Hurricane Irene. Guard unit deploys to Afghanistan. Guard diverts training missions to assist lost hunter. Guard helps woman in medical distress. Guard rescues three from downed aircraft. Guard brings Operation Santa Claus to remote villages, and I've been privileged to go on some of those trips to these villages. The Alaska National Guard can't be mentioned in the same sentence without the words assist, deploy, help, perform, rescue, save, or serve. The Guard has a presence in more than 75 communities throughout Alaska, and it promotes positive values and activities. One example of that is the highly effective Alaska Counter-Drug Support Program. Since 2003, roughly 1,500 of our Guard members had deployed overseas in support of Operation Iraqi Freedom and Operation Enduring Freedom in Afghanistan. HB 247 recognizes the value and dedication of the Guard and its role in the viability, economy, security, and overall well-being of our state and country. I believe we should honor the National Guard with a day of its own each year on July 30th. And that's the day, same day, which in 1948 the Guard was officially recognized, authorized by Congress. And your passage of HB 247 is respectfully requested. It did pass out of our House Military and Veterans Affairs Committee with a unanimous vote. My staffer, Mike Seeker, is in the audience present. If you have any questions for him, and we have online and ready to testify, we have Lieutenant General Craig Campbell, former head of the National Guard, who will be testifying, as well as Cordova City Manager Mark Lynch, the former Cordova Mayor Tim Joyce, who served as public information officer during the recent snow emergency, and Jennifer Gibbons, the newspaper editor of the Cordova Times. So with that, are there any questions at this point? If not, I'd like to see General Campbell is online.
Chairman Lynn, this is Lieutenant General Craig Campbell.
Good morning, sir. Thank you for your service.
Thank you. And members of the committee, through the chair, thank you for allowing me to testify today. I also testified before the House Military and Veterans Affairs Committee in favor of this bill and submitted that testimony in written form so for the committee to have on record. So today, what I'd like to do is reinforce some of the principal comments that I made a couple days ago in front of the Military and Veterans Affairs Committee. This bill is absolutely outstanding, and I want to thank the sponsors and co-sponsors for putting this legislation forward. And I do hope that the committee will favorably pass it out today. I can never stop positively talking about the National Guard and specifically about the Alaska Guard. But today you're going to hear from members from Cordova, and you're going to get real-time testimony of what the National Guard in Alaska has recently done to one community. Very favorable, very positive, exactly what the National Guard is designed to do. So I'd like to go back and just give a synopsis of the National Guard and its perspective to our country and our state. And the reason why I think this legislation is so appropriate for the state of Alaska to have in law. First, let me start with the fact that the National Guard is the oldest component of the armed forces in the United States. That's important. We, in the National Guard, were the first military in this land of North America that we now call the United States. First organized by decree in Massachusetts in 1636, the National Guard last year celebrated their 375th anniversary. That's pretty phenomenal. This is an institution that's been alive and well long before we actually were a country. Now, what makes it so important? The militia, the National Guard, which was then called the militia, was established to protect your town. The people were part-timers, they were farmers, they were the blacksmiths, storekeepers, school teachers, and they come together to defend their community from any threats external. And back in the 1600s, very soon after the English established their colony in Massachusetts, they were in the wars with the Indians. It was called the King Philip's Wars, and the militia were the primary line of defense for the communities at that time. The militia, which is now the National Guard, is the only military service that through those 375 years has evolved to be both a state and federal military. It's the only one, and that's the key point of this whole testimony. There are lots of members of the military in the United States, active duty and reserve. Only the National Guard are both members of a federal force and a state force. And under the state force, they're under the control of the governor. As a state force, they respond to the needs of the state. So, how did that happen? Well, the Constitution, when it was established and written by our founding fathers, put in a specific requirement, and that is, I quote, that Congress is empowered to provide for organizing, arming, and disciplining the militia, a federal responsibility, unquote. However, the state militias portion that the founding fathers also put in the Constitution was that it was reserved to the governors of the states for the appointment of the officers and the training of the militia. Thereby, the militia members would come in under the state and would be activated by the federal government when needed. That's the construct even used today. Today, your National Guard in Alaska works for the governor. And only when mobilized by the president, under authority by the president, do they work for the federal government. So often that's missed by those in the public. They think the National Guard is just another federal force. It's primarily a state force activated for federal use when necessary. It's the only dual state-federal force we have. As Representative Loon mentioned, we were actually started formally as the National Guard in 1947, but Congress activated the National Guard as a National Guard in July of 1948. So the date that was picked for this legislation is very significant to the National Guard across our nation. All 54 states, territories, and the District of Columbia have National Guard units, both Army and Air. And today, there are over 500,000 members in the National Guard across our great country. Let me just talk about Alaska for a moment, with the establishment in our state, because it started right about the time, we're still a territory, right about the time of World War II. Governor Greening initiated formal actions to have a territorial guard, a National Guard in the territory in 1939, and soon thereafter we were at war. Congress agreed to have a National Guard in the state of Alaska, and the 297th Infantry Battalion was established. That's the Alaska Army National Guard, which is the beginning of the Army National Guard in Alaska. However, Governor Greening also understood he needed more forces, and he also established the Alaska Territorial Guard. That was a separate unit, but also as a guard unit within the state, had over 6,600 members, mostly natives, and they served the state and our nation in the state of Alaska. In 2000, Senator Ted Stevens introduced a bill recognizing the service of these ATG members to the United States and directing federal honorable discharge certificates be issued to all who served honorably. And that was important because when Governor Greening established them, they served for about 7 years, and then when they were disbanded, they received no federal recognition at all, no benefits, no pay, nothing in return. So this action in 2000 allowed them to finally receive the same recognition as the National Guard, a state organization receiving that same recognition. And in 2004, the first honorable discharge certificate was issued to former ATG member Sam Herman. In 1952, the Alaska Air National Guard was established when the Army Air Corps separated from the Air Force. So by 1952, we had an Army National Guard and an Air National Guard in the state of Alaska. And today, as Representative Lynn mentioned, there are over 4,000 proud men and women serving in the Alaska Army and Air National Guard. And these are citizen warriors. The other point that most people don't recognize is that the majority, about 70% of those in the National Guard are part-time. They're civilians in our community. They work at the gas station, at the restaurants. They work in the banks and the businesses around our community. And they volunteer their services to be military when needed by the state or the federal government. And since 2003, members of the Alaska National Guard have deployed all over the place, Operation Iraqi Freedom, Operation Enduring Freedom, to places like Iraq, Afghanistan, Kuwait, Qatar, Bahrain, many other countries in the Middle East, as well as to Kosovo, the Horn of Africa, Pakistan, Japan, just a number of places around the world. But one of the things the Guard does best is humanitarian relief. And the Alaska National Guard was very important in the tsunamis in Indonesia. They responded to Haiti, and they've responded around the world, recently to Japan with the tsunami and earthquake over there. They also respond domestically. You heard about the response to Hurricane Irene. One of the greatest responses in our nation's history domestically was the National Guard's response to Hurricane Katrina, which in rapid force, the National Guard was the first force on site and the predominant military force throughout the recovery portion of Hurricane Katrina down Louisiana, Mississippi, and Alabama back in 2005. The National Guard was there. The Alaska National Guard was there. So here in Alaska, you've heard about it. The Alaska Guard responds to floods, earthquakes, volcano eruptions, forest fires, village freeze-ups, you name it. You'll hear about Cordova again. But they also conduct Operation Santa Claus, bring holiday cheer to the children of rural villages, and they conduct Arctic care missions, providing dental care to those in rural Alaska. They serve our state. They serve our state and our nation, and that's the core value of the National Guard. So I'm going to just conclude by, again, thanking you all for having this hearing this morning. I do hope that you will pass out this bill, HB 247. Our state and our nation could not do the wonderful things we do to protect and preserve our state and nation without the unselfish service of our National Guard. It is appropriate that we recognize July 30th each year as Alaska National Guard Day. I thank you for the testimony, and I'll stand by for questions.
Again, thank you, General Campbell, for your great and helpful testimony. Any questions from General Campbell? Thank you, sir. Do we have online Mayor Jim Callender from Cordova?
Representative Lynn, this is Jim Callender, Mayor of Cordova, and I want to thank you for the opportunity to speak to you and thank as well the House State Affairs Committee. We did have a real-life experience with the National Guard. And the response time was pretty unbelievable. I declared a disaster after determining that we had a health and safety issue here due to heavy snowfall, and I made the call, and state Homeland Security stepped in and facilitated the contact with the National Guard, and in less than 24 hours they had made a commitment to come to Cordova, and we desperately needed the help. We were just wore out after 3 weeks of trying to keep basic infrastructure in Cordova going. People's houses and were starting to have problems with structure and as well as losing warehouses and so forth. So they came in the nick of time, and I met with many of the Guard folks, and I knew their moms and dads, and they were definitely Alaskan and carried the Alaska spirit and a real commitment to help us our community was grateful and still are. With me is Tim Joyce, who's the past mayor, and Mark Lynch, and they had a lot of dealings directly with the Coast Guard throughout this this disaster. So I'd like for both of them to tell you some more about what a contribution the National Guard did in our community, and I'm sorry, I guess I just misspoke, and well, the Coast Guard who also stepped up. But anyway, in conclusion, for what I have to say, I fully support the House Bill 247, and I know our whole community does. So with that, Tim, would you like to say something?
Thank you very much, sir. Any questions? Thank you. Mr. Mark Lynch, City Manager of Cordova, are you online?
Yes, sir, I am.
Welcome. State your name and position, please. I just did, but you have to do it, too.
Okay. Mark Lynch. I live here in Cordova on Young Drive. I'm the city manager.
Go ahead with your testimony, sir.
All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, for this opportunity to testify. As the mayor has already said, when the emergency occurred, the residents of Cordova had already been several weeks of shoveling and working very hard to protect their own property. We had received the snowfall in a period of 2 to 3 weeks. It would normally exceed what we would get for an entire season, and folks were just worn out and unable to keep up. And when the emergency was declared, we immediately asked the state for help, and they told us that they could arrange for National Guard to come, and we accepted that offer. And they were here very quickly and went to work right away. And as I said, you know, many times before now, I'm absolutely convinced that they saved property. There's no doubt in my mind that we would have lost additional buildings had they not been here. And it would have been very likely or very possible that we could have lost lives in those buildings. And so in that regard, they were a lifesaver to Cordova. And we are very thankful for all they did here. Without, you know, lingering on this point, I just say that I also support this bill, and I think that the Guard is certainly worthy and deserving of a day of recognition for the service they provide to cities such as ours, as well as the state and the nation. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I turn it back to you.
Thank you very much, sir, for your comments. Any questions? If not, I'd like to go to, excuse me, Mr. Tim Joyce, who's the City of Cordova PIO, you say, the Military Public Information Officer. Are you there, sir? Please introduce yourself.
Yes, good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Tim Joyce, and I am the former mayor of Cordova, and I was the Public Information Officer during our recent snow emergency in Cordova. I can personally attest that it would have been a disaster of a much higher scale if the National Guard had not mustered out to help Cordova in our time of need. We alone cannot express our gratitude, and words alone cannot express that gratitude. It is very appropriate that the state of Alaska recognizes the National Guard on the date of the founding of the National Guard. Cordova has first-hand experience of what it means to have a National Guard that can help state citizens in a time of need. I'd also like to point out that these National Guardsmen have employers that let them go to come to make this assistance, and those are some of the unsung heroes in this whole event. Those people had jobs, and they had homes and families of their own that they had to leave to come here, and those employers let them come and put their own businesses in somewhat of a bind to allow that to happen. We are unified in our support here in Cordova about HB 247, and that we hope now that you and this committee will pass this bill forward today so that it can be taken up and enacted soon within this legislative session. So thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I appreciate the opportunity to testify.
Thank you very much, and I do especially appreciate your comments about the employer, not only in Cordova, but throughout the state of Alaska. Without them, the Guard couldn't do the functions that are so vital to our state. So they are indeed the unsung heroes. Jennifer Gibbons of Cordova Times, are you there?
Good morning.
Good morning. Can you hear me? Identify yourself, please.
Hey, well, hi,
Hi, this is Jennifer Gibbons with the Cordova Times, and I thank you all for the opportunity to speak this morning on HB 247, which is a wonderful bill. And as you've heard a little bit about, you know, our community recently had more than its fair share of snow, and the whole town was just shoveling like mad for weeks. And I remember one morning getting up and walking down to City Hall because I wanted to check in and kind of see what was going on. And between the time I left my house and the time I got down to City Hall, about 4 or 5 blocks, I realized that this snow situation that we were experiencing had reached a tipping point because as I walked through the town, I saw people struggling to save buildings that they knew the roofs were starting to collapse. And it wasn't one, it was two, it was three, and then I heard residents experiencing the same things in their homes. So our town was exhausted, but we were also at a very critical point in this storm. And when the National Guard came in, it was as much a mental boost as it was a manpower boost. We were definitely fatigued. We needed some good, positive, fresh energy, and we needed the manpower. And that's what the National Guard brought to town, and we're just enormously grateful for that. In visiting with some of the National Guard members while they were here, one of the things that they commented on that they appreciated from their standpoint was the opportunity to come in and help in a situation where they were helping to avert greater disaster. And I think you've heard some testimony from our mayor and our city manager that this would have been a far more serious situation. And I completely agree with the city manager that there's a high likelihood that we would have lost some lives if it hadn't been for the help of the National Guard. In visiting with them, and this is one of the reasons I'm so excited about this bill, is that I was so impressed with the members themselves and their positive attitude, their dedication to Alaska, their excitement over the opportunity to be able to come down here and help our community. And they're just a wonderful example of volunteerism and of a very high service ethic. And I think anytime we come across that, it's important to recognize and encourage that. And they sure worked hard. At the end of their first day, they were wiped out, and they were here for, I think, another 10 days after that. So this is a wonderful bill. We definitely appreciate the help that they brought to our town. And as I have told a couple people, the only beef I have with the National Guard is that I wish they stayed longer. But we were sure happy to have them here, and we thank you very much for the opportunity to support this great bill.
Thank you very, very much for your service there in Cordova with the newspaper. And any questions for any of the people who have testified? If not, I'd like to invite everybody on the committee and any legislators who may be watching or in the audience to co-sponsor this bill. Any questions, discussion from the committee? Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I actually already have been a co-sponsor of this legislation.
Excellent.
And I was going to point out that the emergency rescue group from the National Guard is rated as one of the tops, if not the tops, in the country. And as a matter of fact, people from all over the country would like to become a member to experience, have an opportunity to be involved in some of the rescues we have because of the terrain we have in Alaska and all of the water rescues sometimes that are also necessary.
Thank you. Anybody else have any comments? If not, Representative and Vice Chair Keller.
I'd like to make a comment before I move the bill, but I want to thank you as a sponsor and chair of the committee for bringing this forward. I served the Alaska Air Guard in the early 70s, flew the C-123J all over the state, and didn't bend any state property, but quite a few hours on it, and So it is with a lot of pride that I get to move this bill forward, and I am grateful. I move HB 247, version 27LS0982, that's version alpha, out of committee with the accompanying zero fiscal note and individual recommendations.
Any comment? Any objection? Without objection, the bill passes. I'd like to thank the committee and the folks who testified here today. We'll take a short audience while we do the paperwork, and the next bill up is 11. So those who are going to testify on that would get prepared. And I'd like to apologize, Representative Max Grunberg. He's been here for almost all of the hearing of the last bill. So thank you, Grunberg. Next up to bat is SCR 11, Walter Hickel, Day of the Arctic. And I invite Senator French to get in the hot seat there. And before we go any further, I believe we have a committee substitute, so I'd like to hear a motion on the substitute for with objection for discussion.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I'd like to move version LS0774 Mike as the it's a blank CS, but it'll become a state affairs CS upon approval of the committee when we go.
Assuming that we approve it.
Assuming we approve it.
Okay. Good morning, sir. Please give us your name and one moment. Yes.
I think we can adopt it without objection.
Okay, adopt it without objection. Good idea. Okay. Senator French, good morning.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and good morning. For the record, my name is Hollis French. I represent West Anchorage in the State Senate, and I appreciate the committee making time for this resolution this morning. It is about naming Walter Hickel Day of the Arctic. This coming August 18th, 2012. August 18th, of course, is Governor Hickel's birthday, the day he was born. It's really hard to know where to start when you talk about Walter Hickel's accomplishments. And so I'll just tag a few of them. You've got a comprehensive packet there with a lot of information in it, but I just want to touch on a few of them, beginning with his the fact that he was an influential proponent of statehood. The reason we're here today as a state is in some part due to the efforts that he made, the personal efforts he made, flying to Washington countless times to meet with congressional leaders to convince them that Alaska could stand on its own 2 feet economically and support itself. He was Alaska's second governor in 1966. He appointed Ted Stevens to the United States Senate, beginning a remarkable career that benefited the state in literally thousands of ways. He was Secretary of the Interior. He resigned post probably 10 minutes before he was fired for having pushed back against President Nixon in a remarkable display of conscience and forward thinking. He was governor again in 1990, and throughout this entire period, he was a highly successful businessman in Anchorage. I owned a small apartment building myself, and it's all I can handle to manage 24 units. He was managing a large financial empire and doing it well throughout this time. He was just a remarkable, remarkable man. And one of the things I brought with me today was a copy of his book, Crisis in the Commons, which I was really happy to have him sign for me one day when he was here in the Capitol. And I just want to read to you a small selection from that book, if I could, Mr. Chairman. This is what's in the book. If you or I were to travel the world's great open resource regions, too often we would see poor people living on rich land, and many of these lands are commons. We, the people of this world, own most of the planet in common. Our future depends on learning to use and develop this commons for the good of the total and not just for the few. Here in the far north, we built a new state based on that concept. It's the only place like it. The Alaskan people, through our state government, won ownership of much of our land and our natural resources. Using neither classic capitalism nor socialism, we have developed a new way to prosperity based on common ownership and rooted in constitutional democracy. We Alaskans have often disagreed among ourselves. We have fought over our personal visions, ambitions, and interests, but our land came first. It was so much bigger than any one person. The land welded us into one people and brought a new kind of state into the world, a state powered democratically by its commonly owned natural resources. I just find that inspiring, and I will be happy to answer any questions you have about the resolution.
Yes, I was thrilled the first time I met Governor Hickel, a very inspiring person to me, and I too have that book, and I have it autographed by Governor Hickel, and he's been to the Capitol several times, always. The spirit was just remarkable. Where have these heroes gone? Representative Grunberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator French, what, just for the record, what does the new House CS do, and does it meet with your approval?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, it changes the date. The CS that came to you had 2011 as the date. Of course, that date has passed, so we updated that to 2012, and I'm thrilled by the CS.
Secondly, a couple of things that Governor Hickel did that may not be known to folks in the, watching us in the rest of the legislature. Are you aware about the courage it took to build the Captain Cook Hotel where he built it right after the election? Any comment on that?
You know, it's one of the many chapters that really deserves, I mean, you could spend all day here on, through the chair, Representative Grunberg, you could spend all day on the interesting chapters of his life. But after the 1964 earthquake, many people wrote off downtown Anchorage and said it would just never be safe to build there, to live there, or to have a business. And, you know, in typical Wally Hickel fashion, he said, no, I'm going to build a 7-story hotel, and he did. And a few years later, he built a 15-story hotel to go along with that complex, and eventually the 21-story tower there, taking up an entire city block. And it's just another tribute to his strength of will and his financial acumen. He saw the future long before many of his colleagues and many of his contemporaries did.
And Mr. Chair, if I may.
Representative Grunberg.
As I understand it, he built it on rollers, like the Frank Lloyd Wright designed hotel in Tokyo, to withstand the earthquake potential. And when we look at the potential recently for further earthquakes in Tokyo, that may be something that will have a tremendous additional effect, serving as a model as people in Tokyo and Japan try to prevent further disasters. And finally, I'd like to ask one other question. You're familiar with what happened, what the problem was with the court system, and what Governor Hickel did to really, it was revolutionary what he did with the court system. There have been problems in the first court system. There were only 3 justices, and they were in a situation where many of the decisions were 2-1, and they were very shaky legal decisions. And the court system got into a huge fight with the Bar Association and wound up even the Chief Justice ordering a state trooper to withdraw the Bar Association's money from a bank at gunpoint. And it was a tremendous problem, and one of the 3 justices was actually not recalled by the voters of this state. And so it was originally 3-0 and became 2-1. And as a result, the size of the Supreme Court was expanded by the legislature, and Governor Hickel appointed George Boney and Roger Connor, and they completely changed the makeup of the court system and made it into one of the finest court systems in the country. And those legal implications are still being felt today. And it was because of Hickel's vision and the people he appointed just beacons for what's happened today. And I was lucky enough to be a law clerk at that time and to see firsthand what had happened. And I don't think most people know that today. Talk about something a little later that he did, too.
Okay.
Thank you.
Representative Johansson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator, good to see you here in front of the committee. You talked about Governor Hickel and his embracing that we all own the resources. And I know that's been a common theme on quite a few different issues in the building. And where I come from, the frustration that we felt as people living in Ketchikan surrounded by the National Forest. You know, when we were doing the pulp mill battles, we always felt like we live here, we know better than you. And of course, people from California and Washington and Kansas said, hey, that's my forest too. It's a national forest. I have as much right to it as you do. Which is kind of the same concept that Governor Hickel is talking about, I think. And so I was wondering what, since you brought it up, what do you think he really meant? And is do you think that's consistent with that a person from Ketchikan could look at a piece of state land, say an oil lease in Bristol Bay on state land, and say, you know what, I have as much right to develop and own that oil as somebody who lives in Dillingham. Do you think that's what Governor Hickel meant when he meant that all of us own? That's just an example. There are hundreds of examples. Is that the same kind of tone or thread that you believe that he was getting at and that I hear in different arguments in the building?
Through the chair, Representative Johansson, it's a fantastic question. I will not presume to speak for the governor. I'll just say that he, throughout his life, sort of had fascinating chapters of extreme pro-development. You know, the Hickel Highway to the North Slope was, you know, him sending bulldozers north, straight north from Fairbanks to go to the Arctic that wound up being something of an ecological disaster. On the other hand, he, after the Santa Barbara oil spill, found the legal tools to shut down drilling offshore of all waters touching the United States. It was a remarkable feat of willpower and lawyering. I don't know what his views were of the Southeast Forest that frustrate, you know, you and many of you, the folks in your community, and rightly so, because it's your livelihood. He was a pro-development person, I think, at heart, and he knew that you had to use our resources and use them beneficially. And so I don't think he would have ever stood in the way of a wise use of the land.
Follow up? Thank you. Senator, do you personally believe that somebody, a state resident like myself from Ketchikan, has the right, as much right as you from Anchorage or an Alaskan from Dillingham to a resource that happens to be located in maybe in Bristol Bay somewhere?
Through the chair, Representative Johansson, to the extent that my views are relevant to the Walter Hickel resolution you have in front of you, I would say that if it's a state resource, we own it in common, and we develop that resource through this process right here and try to allocate the resources as wisely as we can through the political process.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I didn't mean to press the senator, but he did bring up the idea of all of us owning Alaska's resources as one of the strengths in Walt Hickel's position that would lead me to support this wonderful piece of legislation. So I appreciate his views. Thank you.
Thank you.
Very good. Thank you. That's why we have these hearings. Representative Keller, Vice Chair Keller, had a comment, I believe.
A comment, and then I'll move the bill unless I'm getting hit. Oh, there's another. Okay.
We have a couple more comments after
sure,
that.
That's fine. The comment just simply is that I happen to know a couple of the his cabinet and staff in his second term as governor. And what impressed me about Wally Hickel was his faith, the way he would defend and stand behind his staff. You know, this isn't a question, just a comment. I was really impressed because he would put himself in harm's way. You know, it was at his expense sometimes that he followed the people that he had appointed to lead. And that style of leadership it really impressed me as a much younger Alaskan going, wow, that's amazing.
Thank you. Representative Peterson, then Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I actually read a book called Who Owns America that Wally Hickel wrote. It was part of extra credit I got for a government class that I was taking, and it put a thought in the back of my mind about what a great place Alaska must be, because he did talk about Alaska several times in that book. And so a decade after I read that book, when I had an opportunity to come to Alaska, I took that opportunity, and I've been here ever since.
So Governor Hickel actually was partially responsible for me driving up the Alcan Highway, moving myself to Alaska. And I was actually fortunate enough to meet the governor on one occasion. And so I'm happily will be supporting this resolution.
Great. Very good. Thank you. Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd just like to make a comment that, Governor Hickel's concept of the owner state and pushing that forward has been something that has been vital to the development of our state and is quite unique in among the states. And also, I just wanted to comment that I've been to several of the retreats of the Institute of the North, public open dialogue among Alaskans that has been on issues of the day, not partisan in any way, fully open, with all Alaskans, a diversity of Alaskans, and also the Institute of the North's policy trip to Norway this last year, so that we could expand our horizons and our visions and make sure that we had good background for making decisions. So I think that Governor Hickel's legacy is enduring through what he started, and the Institute of the North and his vision has channeled many directions the state's gone. I appreciate this piece of legislation.
I imagine that Governor Hickel might well have made that trip to Norway had it been possible. Thank you very much. Do we have anybody, first of all, on the line who wants to testify? Is there anybody in the audience who'd like to testify? Please come forward. Good morning, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Nils Andreas, and I'm the managing director of the Institute of the North. And just have some brief comments in support of this resolution. Our heroes' measure of greatness is found not necessarily in what they've done, which they've done many, but in what they inspire in others. Governor Walter J. Hickel lived a life of greatness in his words and deeds. I think for all of those who knew him and of him, the idea of Walter J. Hickel will live on, and he does so through a bill of this nature. The values that will live on in my memory and those that I will try to share with others are those of fearlessness and an indomitable imagination, an unswerving passion for and commitment to the people of Alaska, and the belief that we really can change the world with an idea. Mr. Chairman and members of this committee, you have before you the opportunity to pass those values on to future generations. The Walter J. Hickel Day of the Arctic inspires and demands greatness from Alaskans, and it does so through a lens that was critical to his thinking, that of the North. In the last 12 months, Norway and Russia have resolved a 40-year dispute over ownership over a large portion of the Barents Sea, and Norway just announced two of its largest finds in its history in their portion. Canada recently released its Northern Strategy, reaffirming the United States as a premier partner. An American Secretary of State has, for the first time, attended an Arctic Council meeting. China is building its first icebreaker, and gas has been found off the coast of Greenland. Shipments through the Northern Sea Route and the Bering Strait are increasing. Clearly, the Arctic is central to global affairs, and Alaska is America's Arctic. Let us name August 18 in his honor to remind ourselves of the significance of this statement. Let us celebrate this day as Northerners, reminding the rest of the U.S. that we have unique roles and responsibilities in managing the development of the Arctic's resources, Alaska's resources, on behalf of its people. And let this day remind the world that Alaskans have a voice in the decision-making taking place at an international level. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions? Not any discussion among the committee? If not, Vice Chair Keller?
I move House CS for Senate Concurrent Resolution Number 11, State Affairs Version, and it's 27LS0744. Mike, out of committee with attached zero fiscal note and individual recommendations.
Thank you. Without objection, it passes out of committee. At ease while we do the paperwork. Next before us is HB 77, nonpartisan blanket primary election. I promised Representative Grunberg that we'd hear this bill today, and we are. Representative Grunberg, please introduce the bill and make your comments.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We're taking testimony today. I'm not going to ask to have the bill moved for the record.
Okay, thank you.
And the other bill, too, because there's some additional work we have to do on that.
Yes, the other bill, you mean HB 287.
Right.
Okay.
First of all, the bill, for the record, is sponsor substitute for HB 77, which makes a couple of minor changes from the original.
We need to adopt that.
No. It's been introduced.
Okay.
So if we may, with the chair's permission, take up the sponsor substitute for House Bill 77. I'm here today on behalf of Representative Cisna, and who's co-prime, and here, and I'd ask that she let us both sit over here together, if that's okay, Mr. Chair.
Have to talk to her husband, I guess.
I thought I did. I don't see my
phone. You'd get in trouble,
man. Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
I'm here on behalf of four of us, Representative Cisna, Representative Peterson, Representative Kawasaki, and myself.
Thank you.
Who have introduced a bill that's entitled the Top Two Nonpartisan Blanket Primary Election Legislation. A little historical background.
Bring the microphone closer, please.
Sure. Is that better? Okay, good. In the early days of statehood, we had in Alaska what was called the Black Line Primary Ballot. There was one ballot that was given to everybody, and on the one side were the Democrats, and on the other side were the Republicans. And people could vote whatever they wanted, but they couldn't cross the black line. And if you did, that would invalidate the entire ballot. And that has come to be known as a classic open primary. When Governor Hickel, Wally Hickel, became governor, and Ted Stevens was the majority leader, it may have been actually the very first bill they passed, but it was among the very first anyway, I think it was the first, was to change the Black Line primary bill to what was known as, we called it the open primary, but it was really a blanket primary. And everybody got the same ballot, and everybody could vote for anybody they wanted, and the top Democrat and the top Republican, et cetera, would go on to the general election. Nobody thought a lot about it, but I think people around here liked it a lot, because Alaskans are overwhelmingly not associated politically with any party. They may tend to vote Republican or vote Democratic or Green or whoever, but they are overwhelmingly either nonpartisan or undeclared. Somewhere around 55-56% of the people fall in that category.
I know that in my own district, there are more independents, nonpartisan, undeclared than are Republicans and Democrats put together.
And I think that's true all over, except possibly areas of the Bush, which I really don't know. The Republicans, at last count, had somewhere around 26% of the electorate registered to them. Democrats about 16%, Libertarians I think about 3%, maybe 1% for Greens, etc., some Alaskan independents. But most Alaskans prize very highly the right to vote for anybody they want to. And they had this right until about 1990, when a former member of this body, Fritz Pettyjohn, did some legal research and came up with a theory that the Republicans had a right to close their primary. This they did by court rule. And there was quite a fight, and it was in my last term as majority leader. We fought tooth and nail in this committee on whether to pass legislation that allowed them to do that. And I was very much against that, and Gene Cabino, the chair of the committee, was very much for it. The Republicans happened to be with me, the Democrats with him, and we took the fight to the House floor, and actually we lost, but the bill didn't pass. And ultimately, a consent decree was entered into federal court, allowing the Republicans to close their primary. And in the mid-1990s, in about 1993, a man named Mike O'Callaghan challenged that. He represented himself in Superior Court, and Judge Brian Shortell gave summary judgment in favor of the state, saying that what the Republicans had done was unconstitutional under the Constitution. They didn't have a right to do away with the, I'm going to call it the blanket primary. The case went up to the state Supreme Court, and in a very unusual decision, the Supreme Court published an order that said, number one, they couldn't stipulate as to the law, so the stipulation was invalid. You can stipulate as to facts, but it's up to the court to determine what the law is. Secondly, they invited the political parties and any other interested persons to join the lawsuit at the Supreme Court level to determine whether the blanket primary was or was not constitutional, and conversely, whether the Republicans could do what they did on the constitutional right of association. The are those folks on the line yet?
Yeah, it appears that
I would like to then defer to Ms. Gail Finumiai and to Ms. Elizabeth Libby Bacalar, Assistant Attorney General.
On both. Bacalar, which one would like to go first? But let me get that question, then I'll get the committee.
And they'd like to testify on both this bill and the next bill. They're providing the testimony today, basically.
I think we only testify on the bill that's before the committee.
I understand, but what I would like to do, Mr. Chair, is let them testify on this bill, and then if we could briefly pass to the next bill, because they're in Washington, D.C., and that way we take their testimony one after the other, and then we can come back to this bill.
Yeah, yeah. We could do that. Representative Johansson, I believe.
Well, I was just trying to figure out how we were going. If we want them to testify because of a time crunch, then that's fine, but I really want to get to the gist of why the bill's being introduced. But if we need to do it because of time, I
right.
want to grill
right,
Representative
right.
Grove.
Let's hear from these folks first for your time. Anybody else? Okay. With that, Representative Grunberg, do you have a preference which one goes first?
I would say, unless the ladies have a different choice, let's have Ms. Finumiai go first on this bill. House Bill 77.
Okay, fine. Then we'll deal with the rest of it. Okay, thank you. Ms. Finumiai, are you online? Can you hear us?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I'm here.
Yeah, thank you. Good morning. Please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
I'm Gail Finumiai, Director of the Division of Elections.
Yeah, a little bit louder, please.
Gail Finumiai, okay. Director of Division of Elections.
Thank you. Continue.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I was asked to be available today to address questions of Representative Grunberg. I believe he had a couple questions he wanted to ask me regarding House Bill 77.
Representative Grunberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Ms. Finumiai. Thank you, Ms. Bacalar. I have just a couple of questions, and this is really to let you put some views on the record and to allow the committee members to ask any questions, other questions. My questions are general, Mr. Chair. Number one, for you, Ms. Finumiai, are you familiar with sponsor substitute for House Bill 77?
Through the Chair, Representative Grunberg, yes, I have looked through that bill.
Do you see any problems with implementing it from the Division of Elections point of view?
Through the Chair, Representative Grunberg, the Division, I don't anticipate having any problems with the Division being able to implement the proposed law.
And finally, I see you have a minus $34,000 fiscal note, which would actually apparently save the state money. Would you care to briefly comment on that?
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, that fiscal note reflects a reduction in the number of ballots being required to be printed during the primary election. This bill would require the state to print one ballot for the primary election instead of three ballot styles, resulting in a cost savings of approximately $34,000 each primary election.
And there is a provision in there that will require some signage to put up stating, in accord with what the U.S. Supreme Court has said, that merely designating your party preference, Max Grunberg, Democrat or whatever, is a personal preference and not an endorsement by a political party. Do you see any additional substantial cost in implementing that?
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, no, I do not. As a standard course of our procedures in preparing for each election, we reprint forms and revise forms, and we do have a poster already that is posted in each booth, and I would see that we could add that information to that existing poster.
And this is like the previous blanket primary, is it not, except that the top two vote getters, rather than the top one from each party, will go on to the general. So it could be two Republicans, two Democrats, etc. Do you see that being any great difficulty to implement?
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, I do not see implementing a one-ballot primary style causing the division any difficulty.
Thank you. That completes my question with this witness.
Thank you very much. Any questions for Mr. Numiai? Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I believe the division came to us, and at least we passed out of this committee, I believe, a bill that would change the time frames for elections. And on page 8, we're looking at 30 days before the date of an election. And I think that, how does that interact with the 45 days that you, or I can't remember exactly what those time frames were, but they were made so that military ballots could meet federal law and be sent out earlier. Is there anything in this bill, the way primaries are conducted, additional primary elections that are going to be required for special elections, that would be inconsistent with the bill that you brought to us on changing the dates of primaries and special, and I don't think it was special, but primary and general election, and when ballots are sent
through
out?
The chair, Representative Seaton, in my initial review of the bill, I don't see any changes. The new sections in this bill specifically deal with how the candidates will advance to the general election ballot. The 30-day requirement you mentioned on page 8 is existing statute, and that deals with the appointment of election workers and absentee and question ballot counting review boards. So in my initial review, no, I did not see any conflict with House Bill 178.
Okay. Thank you. And follow up, Mr. Chairman?
I know.
Thank you. So the other question was, there are now, on special elections, there were primaries instituted, which would double the length of time that an election before we would have a sitting senator, as I understand it. Now we would have a 90-day process for an election for a primary and then another 90 days for a special election. Am I correct in that analysis, and does that, from the Division of Elections, does that give us any difficulties?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, I am going to have to get back to you on that. I really have not had, I just got the sponsor substitute late last night, and I really did not take an opportunity to look at timelines that closely. So if the committee is acceptable, I'd like to get back to you with that answer in writing at a later time.
Okay. Thank you. Any further?
I did have one other, and I guess, I believe this question would be one for the sponsor instead of for the division.
Fine.
Thank you.
Ms. Bacalar, are you there?
I am, Mr. Chairman.
Please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
My name is Elizabeth Bacalar, and I'm representing the Department of Law. And I'm here to answer specific questions of Representative.
A little louder, please.
I'm here to answer specific questions from Representative Gruenberg.
Okay, any questions from the committee first? Representative Gruenberg. I beg your pardon. I'll get back to you. Yeah. Representative Gruenberg.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Bacalar, first of all, I appreciate the courtesy of you and the Attorney General in allowing you to testify on this issue. Have you had a chance to review the bill, particularly in light of the U.S. Supreme Court case, Washington State Grange versus Washington State Republican Party, as well as the earlier case of California Democratic Party versus Jones from the U.S. Supreme Court? Have you had a chance to review the bill and generally those cases?
Through the chair, Representative Gruenberg, I have reviewed those cases.
And do you believe that this bill would withstand constitutional challenge?
Through the chair, Representative Gruenberg, I think the bill, to the extent that it mirrors the initiative bill that was enacted in Washington State, 872, that was put at issue in the Grange case, yes, it would survive a facial constitutional challenge on federal First Amendment associational grounds. Beyond that, I really can't speculate as to an as-applied challenge, as to alternative types of challenges, but to the extent it's similar or identical to the Washington state law at issue in the Grange case, it would survive a facial First Amendment federal challenge.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That completes my question.
I'm fine. And I'd like to ask a sponsor a question here. You said, Representative Sidney, you'd like to testify, but I would like to go to the other bill first. Would that be okay? And then come back to this? Okay. With that, I'm going to recess.
Mr. Chairman?
I beg your pardon. Representative Sidney.
Thank you. And I had a question on the... And I don't know if this is part of the Washington one, but on the no party candidates on page 18 of the sponsor substitute version X, in the requirements for basically it seems to eliminate no party candidates in the general election, does that have any legal implications for us in Alaska? And can you just comment on the arrangement where no party candidates are eliminated from general elections?
I'm not really prepared, through the chair, Representative C, I'm not really prepared to testify on that issue at this time. I'd have to get back to you on further research at a later date as to that issue.
And Mr. Chair, I would just request that the Department of Law send a summary or analysis on that to you, and you can distribute to the committee, and I appreciate that.
Will you be able to do that, Ms. Bacalar?
Through the chair, sir, yes, I will be able to do that.
Okay, thank you. Representative Gruenberg?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When and if the committee takes this bill up again, I will also have Alpheus Bullard, who drafted the bill, here and can answer a lot of these questions. The purpose today was simply to get these two witnesses here and get their comments on the record, and depending upon the will of the chair, I would plan, among others, to call Mr. Bullard to answer some of the technical legal questions.
That at a potential future date.
If you choose to hear.
Okay. Okay. With that,
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Johansson.
Thank you. First of all, I'd like to slow down just a little bit because the last 15 minutes, it's been a very obviously orchestrated effort to have the attorney from the Attorney General's office in state affairs, not in judiciary, mind you, to give legal opinions on the record. And inviting Mr. Bullard in to give legal opinions on the record to the State Affairs Committee, talking about constitutional issues. So I'm I really think those should be vetted in the next committee of jurisdiction, where those people are on there for a reason, because they want to be on the Judiciary Committee and deal with constitutional issues. And I know that the gentleman who's been testifying wants to put those opinions on the record. I would, too, if I were in his position. I have a couple of questions, if you don't mind.
Yes.
First of all, today, as a registered Republican, I cannot vote in the Democrat primary, correct?
No.
If
you can't.
If you, as a, if I may follow up.
Follow up.
As a Democrat, you cannot vote in the Republican primary, is that correct?
May I answer?
Yes.
That is correct.
Okay. Follow up, Mr. Chairman.
Follow up. We're going to let this go back and forth between you two.
Okay.
Move it forward. Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman.
No, let him go first. Representative Johansson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Any person in Alaska, if I were registered as undeclared or nonpartisan, the way I understand it, they can vote in the Republican primary. Are they allowed to vote in the Democrat primary?
Yes, they are. Just for the record, anybody can vote in, I'm going to call it the open ballot, even if you're a Republican. If you're a member of another party, you cannot vote in the Republican ballot. You can't go back and forth. A Republican can go back and can choose one or the other. If you're a member of another party, you cannot choose the Republican ballot.
And, Mr. Chairman,
continue.
Who decides whether or not undeclared or nonpartisan people can vote in the Republican primary? Who makes those rules up?
The Republican Party made the rules that allowed nonpartisan and undeclared allowed to vote in either ballot, but they have to choose one or the other.
Follow-up. Can the Democratic Party make the same decision?
Yes.
Okay, so both parties are free to allow anybody or restrict, as to their wishes, who will be able to vote to decide what candidate in whatever party will appear on the general election.
They have that constitutional right to do so under the U.S. Supreme Court case.
Okay. And then finally, when it gets to the general election, anybody can vote for anybody they want.
Absolutely right.
And one final question. Well, not final, but another. Can somebody who is not affiliated with a party file for election and run for state house?
Yes.
And can anybody vote for that person?
In which election?
Well, neither election.
Okay. In the primary, that person would appear a nonpartisan. Well, if you're not affiliated with any party, I'd have to ask Ms. Fanumi. Let's ask Ms. Fanumi that question.
You can do that. I'd just have a couple.
I just want to be. I'm not sure.
Well, we can find out. It's not going to be moved, so we can.
No, we don't plan to move this bill.
Right. And then finally, may I ask, Mr. Chairman, that why would you not allow a political party to control who is going to represent them on a ballot? Why would you allow anybody to vote for Republican or Democrat or whatever? I mean, I just don't understand the basic motivation for this piece of legislation.
Right now, the primary election determines who will represent the party. This changes it into a nonpartisan primary. The reason for that were the top two, and they could be two people of the same party who are nominated. The reason for that is because that's the only way, legal way, to have a truly open ballot under the First Amendment right of association of the parties. The two U.S. Supreme Court cases, to get read together, stand for the proposition that if the primary determines who the top vote getter for the Republicans and the top vote getter for the Democrats are, if that's the way it's set up, the parties have a constitutional right to determine the method of electing their representatives. Only if the primary election is nonpartisan can everybody get a ballot and vote back and forth whoever they want to. In that case, it is no longer a creature of the parties, but it's a creature of the people. And our goal here, and I hope I'm speaking for Representative Peterson and Kawasaki and others, that our goal here is to restore to the greatest possible extent the right of the people to vote for anybody they want to. So you could vote for a Democrat for one race, a Republican for another, etc. The reason for that is because many races are decided in the primary. Many election districts, particularly in small house races, local races, well, I'm not just in the local because they're nonpartisan, but in our races, many of the districts are essentially one party. And to allow all the people to help determine who will go and be able to serve to represent them, we've tried to reopen the primary here. And in the two states that were affected, the other two states that had blanket primaries, since the U.S. Supreme Court came out in the Jones case, Democratic Party v. Jones, they have both adopted initiatives overwhelmingly returning this right to the people. 60% voted for it in California. Oregon did not adopt it. But we think that the people here, number one, have a right to have that choice in their hands, and number two, that it is constitutional. Okay. Long answers. Thank you.
I'd like to interject here for just a second. Ms. Fenumiai has had to leave. So she's no longer available because we've taken some time on this. And so if we want, I don't know how long Ms. Bacalar will be available. So we need to get to that. We're going to come back to this. But I want to wrap this up because we don't plan to move, make a motion to move HB 77 under discussion now. But we may want to consider HB 287. So we need to press on. Representative Peterson, excuse me, big apology. Sorry. Representative Johansson.
Thank you. Just to continue the flow of this, and then I'll stop, to wrap it up, for something that's being couched and sold as a highly nonpartisan effort to get partisanship out of it, just in the last 15 minutes there have been press release, Facebook, and Twitter references to this as being a huge priority of the AlaskaDemocrats.com. So for something that's so nonpartisan, and it sure seems to be pushed by a very partisan group, and I'll stop at that point.
I feel I must say
make a quick response.
I wasn't aware of the Democratic Party taking a position. Anyway, and particularly those things. Okay. Can we pass to the other bill so Ms. Bacalar can
tell? We're going to recess HB 77 and open HB 287. Would you make a quickie opening on that, and then we go to Ms. Bacalar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is House Bill 287, and the purpose of it, very briefly, is to make it easier for people to get mail-in absentee ballots.
Okay, let's go to Ms. Bacalar. Are you still there,
sir,
I hope?
Yes, I'm here, Chair, this is Ms. Fenumiai.
Do you have any comments on HB 287, please?
Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
We are going to be offering an amendment to strike Section 1, so that is not going to be on the table. And I'd ask Ms. Bacalar to ignore that section.
Did you hear that, Ms. Bacalar?
I did, sir. Thank you.
Okay, please continue.
Well, Mr. Chair, I think Ms. Fanumiai probably is better suited to testify on the administrative aspects of this provision.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
Ms. Bacalar, when we spoke yesterday in preparation for your testimony today, I asked if the, I'm not sure if I asked you, well, do you see any constitutional issues or not? And you can respond later in writing if you prefer.
I prefer to take the time to respond later in writing, not immediately. I don't see any immediately, but I would, Representative Greenberg, like to take the time to respond to any specific constitutional questions you may have in writing.
And if you could please speak up a little more.
Mr. Chair, I was just saying that I would prefer to respond to specific constitutional questions about this section in writing. I don't feel comfortable opining on the general constitutionality of it without a specific, question posed about it.
Okay, thank
in
you.
Writing, and I'd be happy to respond.
Any questions, Ms. Bacalar?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Greenberg.
I would hope that we would not take a vote on this bill today. It's not. I want to be sure we get all these answers.
Okay. Okay. Ms. Fanumi, I understand that you're back online.
Mr. Chairman, yes, I have about 5 minutes left, and I really apologize for having to depart earlier than I planned.
As you may have gathered,
but I can
recessed,
be here available seven. Right now to answer the questions Representative Greenberg did have of me.
Okay. As you may know, we recessed HB 77. We're now briefly on HB 287, which is absentee voting. Do you have any comments on that particular bill?
I was going to make myself available to answer questions Representative Greenberg had.
Representative Greenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As I said to Ms. Bacalar, I'm going to be moving to strike Section 1, so my questions only relate to Section 2. How would the department have any difficulty administering this bill?
Mr. Chairman, through the Chair, Representative Greenberg, the division doesn't anticipate any problems implementing the bill as written. The division currently allows military and overseas voters to extend their application or absentee by mail application for two general elections. This bill would allow that opportunity for all voters, not just military and overseas. The only difference is the act of actually casting an absentee by mail ballot would then extend the application for 2 years from the date that that ballot was cast.
Okay. Any follow-up?
No. I just would like her available for questions, and if we take the bill up again, we can do more.
Right.
I just wanted to
Thank you very much. I appreciate you folks back in Washington, D.C., being able to help us with these both these bills this morning. And I hope you folks can straighten out Washington, D.C. for us.
Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Okay, I'm going to recess HB 287 and reopen HB 77, nonpartisan blanket primary election.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, may I make an unusual request here?
You may, but I don't know what we're going to do about it.
I guess I'm just going to serve notice that when we take 287 up, I will move to strike Section 1. There's an amendment that I think has been...
Yeah, I think that'd be better.
I'll wait to do that. Okay.
We're on HB 77. I'd like to bring this to a close as soon as we can here, please. I think Reverend Sidney, you wanted to make a comment?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair.
We're on 77 now.
Yes, on HB 77. The comment that I'm making actually follows the history that the Representative Greenberg has been giving you about what has happened historically in terms of an open primary. And it was when, in fact, and he hadn't quite gotten to the fact that he represented at the request of Alaskan Voters for an Open Primary, which was a bipartisan group. Co-chairs, one was a Democrat and one was a Republican. I was the Democratic co-chair.
I figured that.
Yeah. No surprise changes here. And we represented a very large group of bipartisan voters, and Representative Grunberg then, as an attorney, represented us in the case that he was about to talk about, and I'll let him mention that. But in listening to the conversation that's been going on about constitutionality and that kind of stuff, and the concern about the state affairs, and having this really fit into what you're concerned about, what I saw at that time in the mid 1990s was the numbers of people who were crying for a right to be able to express what is Alaskan, and that is the independence of Alaskans, kind of a bullish independence, and we see it in the way that they file. They file many times as independents. But what I've seen recently that follows the effort that we made, and we won it short term, and then there was the national constitutional parts issues that Representative Gruber can speak to much better. But as a state representative myself, and being a person who visits door to door in my community every year, actually, I try to take on different parts in the off years to make sure that I'm not missing anyone, I hear a constant cry for an open primary. And what I hear about, which I have not heard discussed here, but I think it does have some implications for outcomes that make the vote not a really thoughtful vote by the voters. It's because people that I represent switch parties so that they can vote in the closed primary, on the ballot that is closed, to shift the outcomes. And so outcomes can become shifted because people change party, and it really works straight against what maybe a majority wants. And I think it doesn't look that way, but it can work that way. And part of wanting to have an open primary, in my own opinion, is that we actually get what people want, that we actually do make the Constitution count, that we are really representing the people. So that early experience that I did have, and the fact that there were a number of people at that time, and there still appear to be, I think is something very important. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you very much. Did you have anything further to go? I'd like to get to the other bill.
Yeah.
Okay. At that point, I agreed to hear this bill this morning. I had an opportunity not to hear the bill this morning, but as a matter of courtesy to a fellow committee member, I did agree to hear it. Obviously, it raises great philosophical and political questions and philosophies. We probably haven't heard the last of it. I do think, since elections of whatever kind, fall under the purview of our State Affairs Committee, and that's why we heard it here. It's very difficult to hear any bill on any subject that doesn't wander into the purview of other committees we have in the Capitol building here. And I want to thank you for bringing it. I learned a little bit about this, and I think we have another comment down here. Then I'm going to go back to the other bill and bring this to a close. I want to thank you for bringing it forward, and I'll listen to you two guys. Let's go with Representative Peterson first, and then Representative Johansson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I've actually been contacted in numerous times on primary days by constituents who were, let's say, frustrated. Several of them were angry that they could not vote for who they wanted to vote for. They were restricted to take
a certain ballot because of what their registration was. They did not want to change their registration to be able to vote on the other ballot, and so they felt that they were prevented from voting for who they wanted to vote for, and doggone it, they didn't like it one bit. And so you know, there's been mentioned previously that Alaskans are fairly independent in their registration and how they register and how they vote, and they do not like to be restricted in any way. And several people have told me that they don't vote in the primary anymore because they feel like their selection has been reduced. And so I think it's very important that we get as much participation from the public in the election process, not in only the general election, but also in the primary election. And I think going back to a blanket primary, open primary, whatever you want to call it, we get more people out to the polls. And I believe that anytime you increase participation in the democracy, we're going to be all better for it in the long run.
I have some comments, but I'm going to not give them. Representative Johansson.
Just a couple quick questions. You mentioned that you were the co-chair of the effort. Who was the Republican co-chair?
Please speak up a little more.
Sorry. I asked who the Republican co-chair was. Yeah. That was co-chair with Representative.
Yeah, it was Bonnie Jack.
Bonnie Jack, okay. And then you also mentioned that the representative next to you took part in a court case or a lawsuit. So can you just briefly explain, you were an attorney representing or a witness, or and what was what ended up with the court case? Did it?
Sure. May we have a minute to do
just
that?
A quick history lesson would be great.
I don't want to impinge on your scheduling. But yes.
Your schedule, Reverend Grunberg, because you have the other bill.
Yeah. Okay. Let me answer your question, Representative Johansson, if we may dialogue for a minute here. The Republicans, okay, so there was this order from the Alaska Supreme Court inviting people to participate. Sharon's late husband, Stan Robbins, who had been my chief of staff, and Sharon talked about this, and because we had all been very involved in trying to keep the primary open. And I was no longer in office. I was back to practicing law, and the kind of law I practiced was mainly family law, but I also did appeals. And so we thought that we would try to see if we could represent somebody in this issue. We contacted the Democratic Party, and they declined to participate. So we formed AVOP, Alaskan Voters for an Open Primary. And Bonnie Jack was a constituent, a good friend, and very much in favor of the open primary.
And a fellow member of several groups of people who joined this.
There's Representative Sisner.
Pardon me.
Yeah.
Pardon me.
And so we formed Alaskan Voters for an Open Primary and circulated a petition so people could join. Got about 80 people. And then the Women's Political Caucus as a group joined. So we wound up representing members of AVOP, somewhere around 400 people. We were allowed by the Alaska Supreme Court to intervene at the Supreme Court level. And so the state of Alaska, represented by the Attorney General, actually switched sides and came out in favor of the O'Callaghan and supporting the state law, the blanket primary. They were represented, I think, by Jim Baldwin, an assistant attorney general. O'Callaghan represented himself. There were a couple of other individuals. And the Republican Party was represented by Ken Jacobus. And we all participated before the Alaska Supreme Court and in the O'Callaghan case. And the Alaska Supreme Court upheld the blanket primary and struck down the Republican closed primary. Then Mr. Jacobus took a petition for review
petition for cert to the U.S. Supreme Court. We opposed that, and they turned down cert. And in the meantime, California, on the day the Alaska Supreme Court decision came out, I think it was in 94, California passed an initiative adopting an Alaska-Washington-type open primary. And that was immediately challenged in federal district court in Sacramento. And in a lengthy opinion, the district court judge there upheld the California open primary. In an unusual move, the Ninth Circuit came out with a one-paragraph opinion adopting his decision as its own. And the case was granted cert by the U.S. Supreme Court, which held in a 7-2 vote that the blanket primary was an unconstitutional abridgment of the political party's right of association. There was dicta comments in the majority decision and the minority decision both that if this was turned into a nonpartisan primary, it would withstand constitutional challenge. And therefore, when the Washington voters passed an initiative, the main challenge was, since people could designate their political affiliate, what party they would stand for, that their views were, self-designation, whether that also would run afoul of the party's right of association. And in the Grange case, the second U.S. Supreme Court decision, the U.S. Supreme Court said, as long as it was very clear that this was self-designation only and no political party officially involved, they had a right to do that. And that is why not only did we, in this bill, take the language from the Washington statute, which is now the California statute also, but we put additional things in that specifically require that there be signage, that the language appear in the election pamphlet and on the ballot that says this is self-designation only, does not imply endorsement by any political party. And as a lawyer, I feel very strongly that this will withstand constitutional challenge. In fact, it's even stronger than the language that was upheld in the Grange case.
Very good. Representative Johansson, then we're going to bring this to a close.
Okay. I just want to say this back to the representative and make sure that I understand it. So you were part of a lawsuit and you lost. Yes. But to this, no, I don't. Just let me summarize, please. Okay. There was a lawsuit, went to the Supreme Court, ultimately you lost, and they said, come back and it's in this form, it's going to be okay. And California and Washington led the pack in rewriting a way to, basically, you could characterize it as getting around or satisfying suggestions to get where you wanted to go. And we're basically third in line following the lead of California and Washington in defining how we should do our primaries. Would that be an accurate characterization?
Yes, those were the only three states. Louisiana had a similar thing.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Those were the only states that did it, yeah.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And just, you know, it seems like we're getting off a little here. And I want to just make sure
that's
that
we're going to bring her to a close. Yes.
I am. And I'm trying to say that I think that the problem we're trying to address, or that this bill tries to address, is the fact that if we have an election and I take a primary ballot but let's say it's a gubernatorial election and I'm going to vote for governor. If there's a House contest that I'm an electorate of, not running for office, and there's two Democrats running for that, if I take the Republican ballot, I don't get to vote for the person that's going to represent me in the state house. So the person that wins that primary wins the election, and the Republicans who took the Republican ballot have no voice in selecting their either representative or senator if that was between two Democrats. And the reverse is also the case. If there's two Republicans and someone has taken the Democratic ballot because they want to vote for something in the, let's say it's a gubernatorial Democratic contest, then they are excluded from voting for the person that will represent them in the House or the Senate, whichever election that is. So I think that that has been the frustration that some people in my district have expressed. When I won the election, it wasn't a primary contest, and a good portion of the electorate wasn't able to choose among the candidates that were going to elect them when I first ran. So I understand the issue. I'm not sure that this is the way to get there, but I think that that is the issue that's been expressed to me on several occasions. So I don't want to get lost too much. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And of course, the whole debate is, I suppose, that political parties, Republican or Democrat, have a right to choose their own representatives. It's a Democrat Party, it's a Republican Party, and why shouldn't these two parties and other parties be able to choose their own representative without people who are not members of that party getting into the mix? So I'd like to thank you for presentation today. Any concluding comments, and then we're going to move on.
Let's move on before we have to move out.
Yeah, that's right. Okay. Again, thank you. I'm going to bring close HB 77, and then we're going to reopen HB 287. Is open again, and I'm going to close testimony on HB 287. We have Representative Peterson has a bill on the same general topic, and we might want to put those on, on the same date so we can act as we should.
Thank you.
I understand you do have a proposed amendment on 287. We can take that up.
Could we do that now? I just want to strike section one so that because we're not going to pursue that. That way we have just section two.
Okay. Briefly tell us what section one is, and we'll take a vote.
First, if I may, I'd like to introduce my staffer, Ted Madsen, who's worked a lot on both bills, and there wasn't any time or place for him to be up here before, but he is the person who's been handling this whole thing, and I just wanted him up here with me.
Mr. Madsen, identify yourself.
Identify yourself.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Ted Madsen, staffer representative Max Gruenberg.
I would like at this point, just for housekeeping, to move, can we call this amendment number one, which strikes section one?
Amendment number one, proposing to strike section one.
I move the amendment.
Okay.
I'll object.
Object for discussion?
Yeah. The reason we have stricken it is because of the memorandum from Deborah Bitney, who's the director of the Permanent Fund Division. And originally, section one was to help get information on possible folks who would not be entitled to permanent fund dividends. As she says in here, I appreciate your interest in assisting the division with our audit process, but don't see this particular approach producing the desired result. And therefore, to keep the bill simple, I'm just striking that provision and would ask that we take it without objection.
Okay, any questions for the sponsor? Okay. If not, you move the bill. You move the amendment number one?
I did.
Without objection, amendment number one.
I remove.
You remove the objection. I beg your pardon. Okay. With that, we don't have the schedule yet for the next state affairs meeting. Somebody may bring in a request for a hearing on some bill between now and I think it's 4 o'clock. And so I'll let the committee members know what we expect to hear on the next state affairs meeting.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate your taking this bill today and would ask that we could proceed with this one and potentially with Representative Peterson's in accord with your own desires.
Yeah,
your desire.
Okay. My staffer tells me we need to clarify on amendment number one that it was to delete all material. Right?
Strike
lines 3 to 9.
That's
And then what about the second part?
And then page 1, line 10, delete.
Oh, no, that just means we renumber the section. Since there's no longer a section 2, it'll become section 1.
Got it?
That's just conforming.
Okay. Thank you to the committee. We are adjourned.